Chicago's Edgewater Beach Hotel houses this top studio of its time. Drapes hide microphones, glass walls shut out unwanted sound.
You are listening to station WGN. Our Memorial Day musical program continues.
So WGN Radio has had a long storied history, celebrating 95 years this month. Saturday, June 1st was the day a short-lived station with the call letters WDAP was purchased outright by the Chicago Tribune and became WGN. Back in 1921, Colonel McCormick jumped into the new medium of radio and agreed to supply Chicago Tribune news and market reports for Westinghouse Electric's KYW, Chicago's first radio station. Thousands of listeners in a 500-mile radius from Chicago tuned into a nightly music and news program broadcast from the top of the Commonwealth Edison Building. It was in 1922 that an experimental radio station in Chicago was launched that eventually became WGN. And to take us through the history of our station is broadcaster and radio historian Chuck Shaden, who was the producer and host of the long-running Those Were the Days radio program. We retired from the show about 10 years ago after 39 years on the air. Chuck's treasure trove of vintage interviews from the golden age of radio can be heard on his website, speakingofradio.com. And this legendary Radio Hall of Famer joins us this morning. Good morning, Chuck.
Thank you. It's going to be a tiptoe through the tulips, right, for us?
It certainly is, Chuck.
Early days of WGN Radio. Right. Anyway, I'm delighted to be here with you tonight.
Well, thanks for being here. You know, this is the milestone that I was referring to, Chuck. So One evening in early 1924, Colonel McCormick and his mother were given a special radio demonstration, and it really excited him. And while the Tribune, you know, could have applied, like others, for their own license, the Colonel wanted to lease time, kind of dipping his toe into radio, then owning it. But on March 23rd, 1924, which is today, he entered into an agreement to rent time and facilities from WJAZ. And in addition to the news, the Tribune provided musical programming and other things as well. And the station was actually launched this week on March 29th. It wasn't ours. We were still leasing, but it was March 29th.
And they used the WGN call letters.
Yes, for the first time.
Yeah. Now, then a little later after that, there was another station in town called WDAP.
Okay.
And it had been owned by the Drake Hotel, or it was at the Drake Hotel. And then they moved over, WGN moved over to the top of the Drake, and they were using for a little while the WDAP call letters. Then they changed them to WGN, and there they had studios atop the Drake Hotel until it moved to the Tribune Tower quite a few years later in 1935.
Wow. And, you know, what's amazing here is that, you know, you talked about WDAP. Now, these were some young Chicago guys. They were radio enthusiasts. And it was Thorne Donnelly and Elliot Jenkins from Midwest Radio Central that started this experimental station that was DAP at one time. And it started broadcasting from the Wrigley Building right across the street, of course, from the Tribune Tower. And, you know, again, there was only those two guys, a couple of other programming guys, and, you know, there would be live dance music, but they also did some programming in the Drake Hotel as well.
Well, yeah, they occupied, get a load of this, two handball courts near the top of the Drake Hotel.
Really?
Yeah.
That's where the stations were.
And the reason they moved from the Wrigley Building because a tornado went through town and damaged the antenna atop the Wrigley Building.
Wow.
Right up, the antenna was up near the, you know, in the tower by the clock on top of the Wrigley Building.
You know, I've seen pictures of WDAP and that first radio station, and I noticed that the ceilings were very high, and I thought it looked more like you would do something in a television studio. Of course, television wasn't around back then with lighting and so forth, but I thought, boy, they're very narrow and very tall. So they were...
Well, yeah, go ahead.
No, so they were handball courts.
Well... Yeah, that's they weren't going to lower the ceiling for this stuff, but they had to drape everything with heavy fabrics like drapes and all of that to deaden the sound. You know, those early radio studios looked a lot like what you would see in a living room of a very well-off family in the early 1920s. And they would have plush, thick carpeting all around. They had drapes on the wall. And then here for the radio studio, they even had heavy draperies hanging from the ceiling or covering the ceiling.
Okay.
And you would almost think it was a living room because you could hardly almost, if you look closely, you could see the microphone or two.
Yeah, right.
But otherwise, no, there were some easy chairs in there and a couple of desks and always a grand piano in the studio. And it was very comfortable, but no windows. There were never any windows in these early studios because that, of course, would break the sound barrier, so to speak.
Right. They didn't have this, you know, the silencing windows and layers that we have today. But then it was 1923. So again, we're leading up to when WGN was really launched. Board of Trade purchased WDAP. And then they started. But it was also back then it was really a lot of music and maybe some news. There wasn't even sports back then. It was a lot of music, right? I mean, that's really what kind of launched radio.
Oh, yeah. And much of it was not recorded, but it was live music. And they in those days, those stations, as much as they were going along, like WGN, working on a shoestring kind of a budget and not really hoping to get much revenue from such nasty things as sponsors, as they used to think about. So they thought that they would... They wanted to do the best they could for programming, so then they had an orchestra. It might have been a 6-piece orchestra or a 12-piece orchestra, and they broke up members of the orchestra into little ensembles, and they would be performing at different times of the day. And in the early days, no wire services were going into WGN, but the Tribune was providing stories, news stories, and stock reports, and a few other things. Sometimes you get little brief news reports, they would call them headlines today, but basically that's what they were doing. All for that little box that picks up sounds from the air.
Yeah, right. Well, you were talking about a shoestring budget. I think we're still on a shoestring budget over here.
Yeah.
That's
well,
a radio
that's
business
radio
I've learned.
Today. Yes,
that's exactly. That's right. So, you know, he was leasing WJZ. Now, this was a station that was launched by Zenith in 1923 at the Edgewater Beach Hotel.
Right. Which later took on call letters of WEBH, which, of course, stood for the Edgewater Beach Hotel.
Okay.
And, by the way, you might as well mention that WGN stood for what Colonel McCormick called the Chicago Tribune, the world's greatest newspaper.
Right, exactly.
WGN.
And they
wouldn't call it the world's greatest station because they didn't have any background on that yet, but it was always the world's greatest newspaper, yeah.
Now, what's funny is in 1924, as really we were approaching the launch the station, that there were the Chicago Tribune stated that there was more than 100,000 radio sets in the Chicago area, and I would think that's a lot for back then because that was an expensive piece to have in your home.
Well, you might think it is an awful lot of sets in the Chicago area, but I'll tell you, this was the biggest thing ever. This was the greatest thing since vaudeville and phonograph records to have as Colonel told his mother, a little box in your home to bring you this entertainment into it. And interestingly enough, most of those sets were pretty easily priced.
Okay.
And you would buy a radio receiver, but you didn't necessarily get the tubes with it, and you didn't necessarily get the speaker with it. So we were buying components. I wasn't, but somebody was buying. They were,
I get
you were
what you're
buying
saying.
The component
mm-hmm.
parts. So if you wanted to, you bought your radio receiver from Marshall Field and Company. Then if you wanted to, you could go to your local, there's a local radio store, and you would buy the tubes for that radio. And then you, of course, had to have some kind of a speaker. And there were many stores that were selling speakers. And you could buy a speaker that would be compatible with the decor you had in your home. So you had you might have bought a big console radio, or you might have had a table radio, but you could get a speaker of any size or any quality to put along with that. So, and you'd plug it in.
So you were essentially building your own radio. I mean, that's what you're doing, so to speak.
You weren't manufacturing it, but you were buying the parts for it.
Yeah.
And think about people who did that at the very beginning of the radio days, and years later when they got one of these now very clumsy transistor radios.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so, no kidding, right?
And it had everything right there with it, you know.
Yeah.
So it was quite a thing, and everybody had the radio, and nobody went out. Radio is one of the things that killed vaudeville.
Right.
But vaudeville, on the other hand, went on to supply radio with a lot of its stars.
For 30 years.
And performers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right up into TV.
Yeah, it was, absolutely.
And so everybody had a radio, and many people had crystal sets, or many people had radios without speakers, but they were using earphones. My father used to tell me about many families had a big punch bowl, a glass punch bowl, and they put the punch bowl in the center of the dining room table, and then they had the radio over there someplace, a little table model type radio, and you had the earphones. And you'd plug them into the radio, and you'd lay the earphones in at the bottom of the punch bowl. And the punch bowl acted as an amplifier and a speaker so that several people could sit around and listen
That's
to the
brilliant.
Radio.
That's brilliant.
Instead of one person at a time with the headset on. Because if you only had one headset, you'd say, well, you can listen for a half an hour. No, I'm going to listen. And then the next guy's going to listen. And the third guy's going to listen.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing you say that is now, now that we have iPhones and smartphones, the way I will play something, if I'm playing it, I want somebody to hear something, hear a message or hear something that I found, I will cup my hand kind of, and everybody does this, they cup their hand on the bottom of the phone so that it amplifies off your hand a little bit.
All
so
right.
that it,
yes.
so it's very
same
funny.
Story.
But, yeah, same story. Now, what's cool is that when we launched this on March 29th, again, assuming control of WJAZ, we weren't on 720. 720 didn't come till later. We were on
Shared a frequency with WMAQ, I think.
Yeah, so they were on 670, and then we eventually moved to 810 AM.
Right.
And again, it was all kinds of music, and the schedule at that time included a 5-hour broadcast to be heard almost 10,000 miles across the Pacific.
Well, that's the skip,
Yeah, that's the skip. I know, that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, and it's. Well, we get to the heyday a little later, but it was very big, all of this stuff. And WGN really was a leader in Chicago radio because they didn't depend just on programming coming out of the studio. They did a lot of remote broadcasts, and I'm talking a little bit about the band remotes and things that they had, but I'm talking about special event things like in Memorial Day of 1924, they covered the Indy 500.
Yeah, isn't that something?
It wasn't known as the Indy 500 at that time, but the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, But listeners heard that, and they also heard there was an announcer by the name of A.W. Caney, and he called the race so that people could find out what's going on. And he did this station identification. He said, this is WDAP, soon to be WGN, located on the Drake Hotel, Chicago.
That's cool. So that was because really it was the next day. It was the next day that, June 1st, that
That's right.
we
well,
really launched.
Say, but soon to be heard, it was the next day, June the 1st, yeah. Then on June the 1st, they said, this is WGN, formerly WDAP.
And that was Elliot Jenkins, who I believe was one of
the... That was the announcer.
Yeah, that was the announcer. Wow. And then it goes from there. I mean, I'm looking at some of the, in October 1st of 1924, which I think is just a milestone, is Sen Caney, who you were talking about. He broadcast the first baseball game, a City Series matchup between the Cubs and the White Sox. So it was October 1st, 1924, that we first started airing the Chicago Cubs on the station.
Dave, could that have been a Subway Series?
That could have been.
Did we have that?
I guess so. No, I guess so.
I'm not sure. I know more radio than they do Chicago. But I don't know when the Subway came in there, but it was like, the crosstown stuff. So that was pretty good. But that was just a one-shot thing. It was a City Series, and they did that broadcasting thing. And then they had a football game from Memorial Stadium in Champaign, and that's a game where Illinois beat Michigan and Quinn Ryan was behind the microphone. Quinn Ryan, a legendary WGN broadcaster. He's been deified over the years, and he's really synonymous with WGN in those early days. He told listeners about the four touchdowns that Red Grange scored in the first 12 minutes of that.
That's awesome.
Can you believe that?
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. Well, I'll tell you what, there's so much more milestones to talk about really in the early days. And right now we're talking to radio historian and Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shaden about the early days of WGN Radio. And there's much more ahead on 720 WGN. It's Dave Player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Chuck Shaden, my friend, radio historian, and Radio Hall of Famer about the early days of WGN Radio. So now we've kind of passed through really how WGN was put together. And then in 1925, New Year's, and I know this because, you know, Orion Samuelson does the Tournament of Roses parade for various TV stations and radio stations across the country. But we aired it for the first time on January 1st of 1925.
Yeah, but and that was Quinn Ryan again. But Quinn was not in Pasadena for that game.
Okay.
Quinn was in the WGN studio in the Drake Hotel, and he was getting ticker tape coverage. And he used it like Ronald Reagan broadcast other baseball games years later. And many announcers used to do this, but this was really something. He's broadcasting the Tournament of Roses parade. Now, all you're doing is you're going to be describing every one of those floats and all of that stuff, right?
Right, right.
And so here he is reading it from the ticker tape.
Wow.
And they had in the studio a brass band and some alumni from Notre Dame, as they were in the game, and they had cheerleaders in the studio, adding to the atmosphere. So there was sound effects and ambience. But he was really reading it from the ticker tape. Now, in other occasions, I've heard from broadcasters who were doing baseball reenactments of this, and it was not uncommon because they weren't going to the game, and they would be reading it off the ticker.
Wow.
And the ticker would just have abbreviated stuff, strike one, strike two, so forth and so on. But every once in a while, the ticker tape would break, or there would be a breakdown in the feed. And these guys had a vamp.
I guess so.
So he says, swing and a miss, foul ball. You know, he got 16 foul balls while they were repairing the ticker tape. But they did it in order, and he was doing the Tournament of Roses game using the reports, and they beat Notre Dame beat Stanford 27-10.
And then later that spring, it just puts you in perspective of what time in our history this was. But they were hosting a prohibition debate, WGN, with 47,000 listeners. They voted 3-1 against prohibition. But I mean, you think about how important though this station is. Not only to Chicago, but to America, just from an informational standpoint, and we were part of the prohibition debate in 1925.
Well, people used to have to wait for the newspaper to come out to get any kind of information or to read about a debate. But now with radio on the scene, they could hear about it right on the spot, and they could hear things. You know, the Tribune would have to come out with an extra edition for some special event that was going on or some news, breaking news. But with radio, bang, it was right there.
Yeah.
And, of course, this was a little bone of contention between radio and newspapers in the beginning, because the radio was trying to get some information from the newspapers, and the newspapers didn't want them to have that. And initially the newspapers, not the Tribune, because the Tribune was at WGN right away. But many newspapers refused to publish the radio listings because they didn't want the readers to go to radio for information. They wanted to go to newspapers. But eventually they came together, and they all realized the value of radio to newspapers and the value of newspapers to radio.
Especially this organization here.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. And it kind of changed now. soon, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's going to be changing toward the end of the year, end of the summer. It's going to split. But I'm sure there's still going to be some strategic alliances between the groups, of course. So later in April 14th, there was the first Cubs game, the regular season Cubs game. But then in the summertime, there was the Scopes Monkey Trial, which is a really famous trial that WGN provided coverage for. Share with us a little information about that.
Well, they took the microphone. Quinn Ryan, again, reporting. He took an engineer by the name of Paul Neal. They took it down to Dayton, Tennessee, where this trial was going to be. And this was William Jennings Bryant and Clarence Darrow involved in the trial of a high school teacher by the name of John Scopes. He was indicted for teaching evolution in high school.
Right, right.
And Brian argued for the prosecution and Darrow for the defense. Now, you want to know how much influence radio had on that particular trial?
Yeah, tell me.
When the WGN microphone arrived, they placed it in the center of the courtroom, and they rearranged the seating in the courtroom around the WGN microphone.
Wow.
So that everybody could listen to this thing. Everybody could speak into the thing. So you had William Jennings Bryan, you had Clarence Darrow, and you had the sound of the judge and all of this sort of thing. And sometimes there was they had to send the jury out of the courtroom because there was something they wanted to discuss. They sent the jury, excuse me, outside of the courthouse on the grounds where speakers were set up so that the public could listen to the trial being broadcast. So the jury is out on the grounds around the courthouse listening to the radio, and the radio is broadcasting what's going on inside the courthouse.
Wow.
So it was an amazing thing.
Absolutely.
And this, of course, this whole idea of WGN and broadcasting this so-called monkey trial from Tennessee was depicted in the movie Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy as
a character
based on Darrow and Frederick March as a character based on Brian.
This was an expensive thing for WGN, too. It was costing, I think, like a grand a day.
Oh, yeah.
To
and
have
it went
these
on
lines.
From the 13th of July till the 21st of August.
But it really put him on the map, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It really put him on the map.
So WGN really was responsible for so many what we would call today actualities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And many actualities today are 40 seconds, but this was, you know, all these days. Amazing.
Well, then here we go. Then later in the fall, the Chicago Tribune purchased two Elgin radio stations to expand their coverage areas. So this is as we start climbing to our 50,000 watts eventually.
Yeah, right.
But for a time, WGN and WLIB, which was Tribune's national magazine Liberty, shared the 980 frequency and went back and forth. So again, I don't think we're still on 720 here. And then, you know, in the fall, then we had a Christmas carol was performed on the radio, which we, by the way, we just did this last Christmas too. So this tradition continues here at WGN.
By the way, I'll mention an aside on this Christmas carol broadcast in December of 1925. It was performed by a person by the name of Bill Hay. Now, Bill Hay was an announcer on WGN. And later, when Amos and Andy emerged, Bill Hay was the announcer for that show, and he opened the program every night with, "Here they are, Amos and Andy."
Very good.
And so there he is going way back to December of 25, sometime before Amos and Andy made an appearance.
Well, yeah, and I know that Amos and Andy, which I want to tell this story too, is something that started on WGN with a different name. Actually, it was this past week, that they celebrated also an anniversary. But tell the story about Sam and Henry into Amos and Andy.
Well, there were two vaudeville-type performers on WGN, singing mostly, by the name of Freeman Gosden and Charles Carell. And they were on here, and they were there on the schedule another place, and they would do these little things. And so they finally gave him an anchor spot on the air. And frankly, it was Colonel McCormick who suggested to the program director of WGN, who suggested to Gosden and Carell, that they do a little sketch on their program based on a very popular Tribune comic strip called The Gumps. Now, Gosden and Carell read the Gumps, as many, many, many people did, but they couldn't figure out how they could bring these two characters, Andy Gump and his wife and all that stuff, to radio. So they kind of dismissed that idea, but eventually they developed a character, the two characters called Sam and Henry, started early in 26. It was set in an African-American community, but the main characters were voiced by these two guys who were Caucasian.
Right.
Anyway, Sam and Henry was very popular, very, very popular. And so...
But it was one of the first sitcoms. It was actually, if not the first, WGN.
Well, I guess you could call it a sitcom. You know,
right.
It's two guys doing stuff on radio.
Yeah.
Bob and Ray did it too, you know,
yeah.
years later. And I don't think we called Bob and Ray a sitcom, but
sure.
Nevertheless.
All right, fair enough.
We had Sam and Henry. So they were doing a good job, and they wanted to expand. They wanted to do more than when they were being heard on WGN, and they tried to do some things with recordings that they could. They called it bicycling from radio station to radio station, kind of forming a little syndicated program to go out there. And that was a little bit difficult, but they had heard that another station in town was soon going to join the Columbia Broadcasting System. And they went over there, and they decided that they would join this other station because they would be on a network, because WGN was an independent station,
yeah.
heard in a large Midwest area, on any kind of a network.
Yeah, not associated with anybody yet.
Right. So Gosin and Carell went up to the top of the Drake Hotel to talk to the boss at WGN, and they said that they had this opportunity to go, and they would like to take it and be relieved of the contract. Well, their contract that they had was really kind of a handshake and didn't hold any real water. So the manager said, "Well, if you guys want to do this, you can do it. It's probably a pretty good break for you. We understand that." First time management ever understood that, right?
yeah, exactly.
And that's another milestone.
Hello.
And they said, "Oh, but by the way, you can't take with you the names Sam and Henry, because by this time, Sam and Henry had become a one-panel comic strip in the Tribune."
Ah, got it.
So now that was copywritten and all that stuff. So they said, "Well, okay, we'll change. We'll do something. We won't take the names with." So they left the manager's office at the top of the Drake. They get into an elevator and they're starting to go down. And they're thinking, "Well, what could we call this?" And they realized that the elevator operator was somebody that they hadn't seen many times. Those were the days before automatic elevators. They had elevator operators in there. And they knew this fella's name happened to be Amos. Didn't register. Elevator descends to the main lobby of the Drake Hotel. The door opens, and there's someone mopping up the lobby of the elevator lobby, and they knew him too because they'd seen him many times as they broadcast their programming from there. And his name was Andy. And Freeman Gosin looked at Charles Carell, and they both at the same time just about said, "Amos and Andy." And Amos and Andy they became, and they took the job, and they went up there, and they became radio's all-time favorites.
Well, and they did this for 30 years, and of course they went into television. But, I mean, it had its controversies really at the end of the 50s and in the 60s, and got pulled out of syndication at one point as well.
Oh, yeah, but you know, when they came on, when they started all of this stuff, blackface on radio was a common thing.
Yeah.
It was all over the place. So they were extraordinarily popular because of how they did it.
Yeah.
And they had people from all over, every walk of life, listening into their program. You have Sam and Henry, and later as Amos and Andy. But started in Chicago at WGN.
But then, you know, we started expanding a little bit more, and you know, there was our first commercial program debuted. It was called the Radio Floorwalker in 1928. What was that all about?
Well, that was a variety program, really. It just had... However, the thing that was made it different was that it had commercials interspersed throughout the program. And listeners were complaining about that. So listeners figured, "I paid for the radio, why do I have to pay for the programming? But I'm not even paying for the programming, but I have to listen to it."
Yeah, right, right.
So they were hearing the commercials, but they were starting to people were starting to respond to those commercials, and they were very very subtle commercials that was going on at that time. But the Tribune, as it were, did not consider radio a commercial enterprise, so they had losses nearly $1 million over the first 15 years the station was on the air.
Wow.
But they persisted, and if they had only had Wally Phillips back in those days,
it would have been, gangbusters. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it was right around
that. That was a nice variety program that they had, and that was music. That was live music, and there was a lot of live music on the air. But they were also, as they did with the remote broadcasts for the special events, they had a lot of remote broadcasts coming from music venues and hotels and nightclubs and places like that all around the city of Chicago. In fact, in some time later, WGN was known as the best station in the nation as far as bands were concerned. And all the bands really owed a great deal of success to WGN and other stations that were carrying those basically sustaining, meaning non-commercial, band remotes from one venue or another. I mean, the Aragon, the Trina, the Edgewater Beach Hotel, downtown hotels like the Palmer House and the Bismarck Hotel, and the Blackhawk Restaurant at Wabash and Randolph. Mm-hmm. That's where the Coon Sanders Nighthawks were broadcasting on a regular basis. And those bands all recognized the fact that people would hear them on the radio in usually the late evening. And then when the band came to their town, they would be recognizable, and people would come out to go see the bands and hear them and dance in person. And that really made it for the big bands. The little bands, the big bands, the local bands, all of the bands were so big because of radio, and WGN had really a terrific signal, and they got all over the place. So they were able to really promote the big band music.
Well, the Blackhawk Restaurant, I mean, that was a very, very popular place for all these bands. And there was, I mean, there's tons of content still out there that I think you can still get, like, through the audio file of a lot of these performances.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was, radio was very big with music, and it really didn't come until much later in the earliest years where they were starting to play recordings. Some of the programs were playing recordings, but, you know, people had records at home.
Mm-hmm.
They had the old wind-up Victrolas.
Sure.
And they opened the two doors in the front, you know, and wind it up on the side and put the needle on it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it would finally go into the music.
Well, what's cool, too, is around this time, Chuck, is that that's when we finally moved, right at the end of 1927, early 1928, that's when we moved to 720. Obviously where we've been ever since. But then there's, we were the first station in 1928, first independent station to broadcast coverage from the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. We were doing police bulletins to those officers and their squad cars. But then it was, 1930, October 11th, that the Tribune, increased its signal strength to our 50,000 watts that we know today.
That's right, and I believe from that point on it was a clear channel, too, so, mm-hmm. meaning no other station in the country could broadcast at 720.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
On the dial. So that was good. You know what kind of a signal that WGN had from Chicago? They could be heard as far north as Minnesota, as far south to central Texas, as far east to western Pennsylvania, and as far west to Utah.
See, now that's amazing. I was actually traveling, I don't know, it was about a year and a half ago when I was in Houston, and it was about 5 o'clock in the morning, so it was still pretty early when I was heading to the airport. And it was faint, and it was a little scratchy, but I could still get, and I think Johnny was on at the time, but I could still get the signal of GN down there, and that absolutely amazed me. I was listening to Blackhawks games when I was in Columbus for a meeting, and I could listen in my rental car while I was driving around. So it's amazing the power of this station. And then, I know in the 1930s, early 1930s, 33, we had some brief associations with NBC and with CBS, but it really wasn't until 1934 that we associated ourselves with a larger broadcasting company.
That's right. There was a group of stations that got together to form a I guess you would call it a network, although it wasn't initially called a mutual broadcasting system, but it became that. And that started in 1934, a very good year, I might add.
Oh, really? Okay, got the hint. All right.
And they combined forces, WGN combined forces with WOR in Newark, New Jersey, which, of course, served the whole eastern seaboard there. Then with WLW in Cincinnati, which had a tremendous signal. In fact, WLW had something like 100,000 watts.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that was possible.
They got shot down on that after a while, but they were 100,000 watts. They were broadcasting into Mexico, you know.
Wow. And that's the Crosley Radio Company that owned that station, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So you had WGN, WOR, WLW, and then they had WXYZ in Detroit.
Okay. All right.
So now each of these stations were contributing something to network programming, because they could provide whatever programming they want, and most of the stations were providing programming that didn't have network commercials in it.
Okay.
They were not nationally sponsored yet. So WGN was doing Lum and Abner. And locally, Lum and Abner might have been sponsored by a malted milk company.
Okay.
But later...
More national?
More national. Okay. And then you can answer this question for sure. What program was the biggest program on the mutual system that came out of Detroit?
I have to say it's the Lone Ranger.
You're right, on WXYZ in Detroit.
Yeah.
That's right. So we had, and that started about 1933. Well, it started in 1933 in Detroit, but then it went on the mutual broadcasting system. So it was really a big thing. And over all the years, the mutual broadcasting system was a network of stations they did not own.
Right. But they contributed.
They owned their own station, but they contributed to it. And it wasn't until many years later in the 1980s that the mutual broadcasting system actually purchased a station, like an owned and operated station. And that was WCFL in Chicago, which is no longer around.
Right,
there's different call letters and all of that sort of thing now.
Sure.
So they had... they had all of that, so it was very interesting. They made a big Horlicks malted milk is what I'm trying to think.
Okay,
of.
All right, for Lum and Abner, yeah,
right.
And then there was the Witch's Tale, which was really the first. You know, we've talked about this before around Halloween about suspense and some of these great, but the Witch's Tale was really one of the first like scary edge of your seat type of programs that were on the radio. And then really at the end of this. In October of 35, WGN dedicated its new home, where we are now, a four-story building built in as an addition to the Tribune Tower. It was $600,000. It was built in the midst of the Great Depression, which is, you know, pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Six studios, a master room, seven studio control centers, workshops, dressing rooms, offices, and a 450-seat studio theater, so that when there was performances, you could have live performances and have crowds come in and watch it. But that was really... really the launch of where we are today. And those are the early days of WGN Radio. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shaden about the 95th anniversary of WGN Radio and its storied history. So WGN, we were talking about the 1930s. Mm-hmm. They were part of a network at the time called the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Right. It was the only network that... did not have any owned and operated stations. It was a programming service kind of a network.
Mm-hmm.
And they were formed by WGN in Chicago, WOR in New York. It was also WLW in Cincinnati and WXYZ in Detroit. And all of those stations joined together to really form what was called the Mutual Broadcasting System. And each of the stations, to some degree, provided programming.
Yeah, they all pitched in, so to speak. Yeah,
for original programming that was heard prior to their organization together, but also and after that would be heard locally, and then it would be heard on the national scale, more or less. And those stations constituted a gigantic part of the coverage because they're all powerful stations.
Right.
Yeah, and so. the Mutual broadcasting system continued for many, many years. It was finally, it dwindled down to just a news and sports service kind of a network.
Sure.
And
but at the time, in the 1930s and 40s, it was big because
it was in competition with CBS and NBC.
But there was no television.
ABC.
This was your source for entertainment.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. And they did all these original programs from the stations that had more or less part of the audience. Some programming that they had was basically like a Bulldog Drummond radio program, a detective kind of a show with not a very well-known actor portraying Bulldog Drummond, with a little organ music and a sound effects guy and never a studio audience for anything like that.
Sure.
But it filled the time, and then the local stations would sell time into those programs as well. But there were a number of major programs heard on the Mutual network that really boomed out across the country and became very, very famous.
So say The Shadow is probably one of the biggest.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men. Yeah, The Shadow.
Yep.
And that was on the air for 10 or 15 years, and it was one of the most...
amazing when you think about that. These radio shows were on for very long periods of time. I mean, it was decades.
And now you talk... Today, everything is what's prime time and what's demographic and all of this stuff. The Shadow was on in Chicago at 4:30 in the afternoon on Sunday. Now, you think Sunday afternoon. Yeah. I mean, there's not... Who would be listening to radio? But... It was 5:30 in the East, and it was a great show, and it was you had heard at one time Orson Welles as Lamont Cranston, a wealthy young man about town who went to the Orient and learned the hypnotic powers to cloud men's minds, and Agnes Moorehead was his companion, the lovely Margot Lane, as they always said. And Orson, you might know this. Orson had difficulty saying "The Shadow knows," and he didn't like to do that. He didn't want to do it. So they had used the voice, a recording of an earlier actor who preceded Orson, Frank Reddick,
came up.
Yeah, and they used that laugh because Orson, he didn't want to do it. He was too busy, and he was playing The Shadow even at the time, around the time he was scaring the dickens out of the country with his War of the Worlds broadcast.
Now, you mentioned Sunday afternoons. Some were different back then. You had an early dinner, afternoon dinner, maybe at 1, 2, 3 o'clock, and then by that time you were kind of settled in and ready to listen to some radio.
Well, that's it. And you would, some people were real radio families and they listened all day long on the weekends and all into the evening.
Sure.
But and sometimes they were visiting. People used to do a lot of relative visiting to one another. And you may not have been to listen to every show and every station at every time, but they were so dependable. The programs, especially these Mutual programs, they were there year in and year out. You can always depend on them. They didn't do a lot of juggling around with the timetables. They didn't put this program over here. They weren't worried. You know what the biggest rating acknowledgement was? It wasn't so much what the Hoover rating had for the station, but it was how many products the sponsor sold. You know, some of those afternoon kids shows, you had Jack Armstrong, for example, and Tom Mix and all those other shows. If they were moving the product off the grocer's shelves, the sponsor says, "That's the rating I want."
Really?
No matter what the agency would say, "Well, you got this kind of an audience. Yeah, I know. That's fine. But I want the boxes to move off the shelves." And that's why they used to get the premiums, the secret decoders and the whistles and all those things.
Oh, highly collectible from
that
time.
And you see those things going, and the sales would be going up, and sponsors would be happy, and agencies would be happy.
And that's the way that went, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Lone Ranger used to be a part of this as well, and that went over to NBC Blue, and then The Adventures of Superman was picked up through WOR.
That's right. Well, now those shows were the Shadow was originating in WOR in New York, and The Lone Ranger originated at WXYZ in Detroit, and that was so big that was starting in 1933, and it was picked up as Mutual became an entity, and then that was followed or added to the success of the Lone Ranger, who rode on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday nights, the Green Hornet came in there and sped with his Black Beauty automobile with his sidekick, his Japanese valet, Kato. Kato was Japanese until December 7th, and then he became a Filipino valet.
Is that right?
That's right. They made the change. Well, sure, because of the Japanese attack on there. And then later on, Sergeant Preston and the Challenge of the Yukon came in there to take care of Saturdays, and so or one other day during the week if there was one opening.
Were these shows, these adventure shows like Lone Ranger, Superman, were they written for kids, or was it really written for everybody?
Most of the shows were written for an audience that could be there listening to it together.
Okay.
So family. Kids and family audiences.
Okay.
You know, dads and boys love the Lone Ranger.
Sure, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
But fathers and sons listen to dramatic programs as well, and with their mothers. Everybody was together.
Right.
You had two radios in your home. One was a console in the living room with a flickering green eye, and the other was a small radio that sat upon the top of your refrigerator in the kitchen. So, and Mom was in the kitchen listening to some of the soap operas on WGN and other
stations. So it was
probably
on in every room of the house at some point.
Well, it didn't come. The radio was on in the two places.
Yeah, you know,
that was stereo.
So while you're walking
radio in the kitchen and one in the living
room. So while you're walking through the house,
That's right.
You didn't miss anything.
That's right.
Now, one of the longest Mutual shows that aired on WGN was The Return of Nick Carter and Nick Carter, Master Detective.
That's right, yeah. They'd say, there'd be knock at the door, bang, 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 bang. Bang, 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 bang. What is it? What is it? This is a case for Nick Carter. You know, we used to laugh. It was a case of Coke, you know, or a case of beer or whatever.
But
those were very low budget programs, but they were very effective, and it gave good programming to these independent stations who independently would not want to have a big cast of actors all the time.
Well, you know, Suspense, which was on CBS, had a lot of famous actors, but on Mutual there was The Mysterious Traveler, which was kind of like a Twilight Zone anthology series.
Yeah, it was. The traveler was aboard a train, and he would be telling the story, and you'd hear the train chugging along, and he was not identified with any name, any character name, but he was the mysterious traveler. Maurice Tarplin was the actor who played the mysterious traveler.
And then there was quiz shows too. So there was 20 Questions, which ran for quite some time on the air, and then Quiet Please. Now that is a little bit more. It's a horror, like a horror genre.
Quiet Please was a little like Lights Out.
Okay.
Not quite as violent as Inner Sanctum, but a little more subtle, like The Lights Out. But that was a very good show, and it was on the Mutual Network, and that came out of Chicago.
So that was done here.
That came out of Chicago, you know.
Okay.
And there's so many things that came out of WGN in Chicago.
But it came out of our studios here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which were in the Tribune Tower
at that time.
Right.
Yeah. And that show, Quiet Please, on a very short period of time, but there's episodes that are very highly regarded
in the old classic
radio days. So one of WGN Radio's legends, Radio Hall of Famer Jack Brickhouse, began his career at WGN Radio all the way back in 1940, Chuck.
Yeah, he started when he was only 18 years old in Peoria on a radio station called WMBD. That was back in 1934.
Wow.
And then WGN hired him in 1940. To broadcast Cubs and White Sox games. Now some GN carried both the Cubs and the White Sox games over there. And they were introduced to Brickhouse by WGN's top announcer at the time, Bob Elson.
I just can't believe that Jack was not only, you know, obviously one of the first big sports guys on WGN radio, but he was the first face to be seen on WGN television.
Well, he was a long-lived guy here on Channel 9 and WGN. That's for sure. He was in the Marines during World War II, and he missed the 1945 season, and that was the only time in his long career as a Cubs announcer. And the Cubs would win the National League pennant at that time. His only pennant as a broadcaster would belong to the White Sox in 1959. But then neither the Cubs nor the White Sox won the World Series in 1945 or 1959. Jack Brickhouse covered many other events, and he always considered himself as an announcer rather than a sports announcer. He told me that he would rather be known as an announcer because he did so many different things. I mean, he announced radio programs, he announced dramatic programs, he announced band remotes. and he did all of that sort of thing. He did other sporting events, too. I mean, he did some professional wrestling. I guess that must have been television. I don't can't imagine the Hans and Fritz Schnabel a tag team match on radio.
But what's amazing, I mean, Chicago Bears football on WGN radio. We forget that it was the 1920s through 70, I believe, that that the Bears played at, at Wrigley Field.
And Irv Cupson from the Daily News, Daily News, the Sun-Times, was his co-host. On the co-commentators, I guess, in that. And Jack Rickhouse would say something, and Cup would say, "That's right, Jack."
Classic stuff.
That's right.
And then the Bulls games. He did Bulls games for WGN television. And then this is amazing again. From 1940 to 1967, he was doing Cubs and White Sox games because they never really played on the same day, and then did the Cubs on WGN until 1981.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a long career.
Once in a while, and not often, but once in a while in those days when the Cubs didn't have lights over at Wrigley Field, Jack would do a Cubs game in the afternoon, and then he'd call a night game from the Sox. They never played at the same time.
Right, right, right.
That was a no-no for the whole city. Yeah. But he could cover this a night game for the Sox.
And he came back, I mean, at WGN to do other specials and stuff over the years, and he would make appearances on WGN radio and WGN television when Harry Carey was out.
That's right.
When he was ill, he came back to the broadcast booth as well.
Did you know that Jack Brickhouse once appeared in a theatrical production? He was he did a play in Chicago, and they did Damn Yankees, and there was a role in there for an announcer who was calling the action, and they had Jack Brickhouse. It was an extra added attraction, Jack Brickhouse. This was probably long after his regular career, but he was happy doing that.
That's
too.
That's pretty cool.
I saw him do that. Yeah.
He interviewed presidents and heads of state.
Yeah.
I mean, he was, as you said, he looked at himself as an interviewer, not just a sports guy.
I'm not really much of a sports guy, yet I interviewed Jack, and I thought, boy, I'm going to be hanging on by my toenails here talking to a big sports guy. But we did a half an hour, and we rarely talked about sports. But we talked about all of the other things that he did.
Yeah.
And that was fascinating for me, too.
Absolutely amazing career. Yeah. Amazing career. Now, other milestones in the 1940s was that WGN launched an FM station. I know this is funny because today we are intending on launching, we've got WGN.FM that will eventually become an FM station. And we had an FM station on March 1st that we launched in 1941.
WGNB.
Okay.
You know, as
very creative.
WGN was A, and and this WGNB, which I thought was a pretty good set of call letters for the FM station.
Sure.
But when they launched the FM station, there were very few FM stations around, and even fewer people listening to FM. And most of the people thought that any FM station at that time would be serious classical music, uninterrupted by crass commercialism, you know.
Now, Ward Quall, who ended up running the station years later, he was the announcer, one of the first voices on WGN-FM.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of wild as well. Then, later that fall, WGN took listeners to the playing field for the first time during a broadcast of a football game between Northwestern and Michigan. They put the microphone out on the gridiron, which was kind of unheard of at that time. So you could hear the players.
Well, they took a chance.
Yeah.
They took a big chance because the mics were open. And these guys were
that's a big chance.
Football
right.
players, right?
Yeah, I just thought about that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
So they must have known. They behaved themselves, I'm assuming.
Well, I guess, yeah.
And then December 7th, tell me the event that happened at Soldier Field.
Well, we were a broadcast of the football game between the Bears and the Cardinals when Ward Quall, who was a young announcer on WGN, He broke in with the news report that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. And for the next 10 days, WGN went to continuous coverage of the attack on Pearl Harbor and the entry of the U.S. into World War II, carrying, of course, everything from that day with the early news reports and then the 8th of December from the Congress, where President Roosevelt gave his speech and WGN was embracing all of the news of World War II. And so many other radio stations came to the forefront then with news coverage because the public needed that stuff. The public wanted that news coverage.
But that was the way, you know, during that time, which was, you know, quite frightening for, mm-hmm. you know, most Americans, that was the quickest way to get the most up-to-date information.
I mean, even though the newspapers had extra editions,
sure.
you still had to wait for the newspapers to be published. But you would know that, I mean, even if you were listening to the Tom Mix Ralston Straight Shooters and something happened, there would be an announcement. Now, I don't know whether they – most of the announcements were just straight announcements. They weren't very graphic announcements. Mm-hmm. But if something was going on, I mean, military bombers from Berlin had bombed such and such or so and so, they would say that. But they weren't giving any casualty reports or anything like that, not especially during kids' programming.
And there was a lot of programming that was done at the time that was specifically done out where the troops were or was mm-hmm. done for the troops as well. A lot of the broadcasts that you collected over mm-hmm. the years, some of those transcription discs were from the was sent to the military, correct?
Right. Well, those mostly would be rebroadcast of network shows from all of the networks,
sure.
from whether Mutual or CBS or NBC, and they cleaned them up. In I'm saying that in that they took out the commercials.
Okay.
So the GI got a half hour program, which was really only maybe 27 minutes.
Yeah,
of programming
yeah.
of the original program, but yeah. then they would add 3 minutes of a band, a number from some other program or something to fill out the 30 minutes. So people all over the world in the military were listening to these shows at various times of the day and night.
That's how we entertained the troops. That's how we entertained
right.
them when they were downtime.
If you were a sailor on a ship
yeah.
at sea,
yeah.
they would be somebody in their radio room playing these 16-inch transcription discs. And then there were special programs, too. It doesn't have anything to do with WGN necessarily, but there were special programs produced by the Armed Forces Radio Service, like Command Performance and the GI Journal and things of that nature.
Well, we are talking to radio historian and Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shaden about the history of WGN Radio. And coming up next, we'll look at the 1950s. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Only one cure for this body of mine. That's to have that girl and a love so fine. She touched my head and what the chill I got.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to my friend, radio historian, and Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shaden on the history of WGN radio in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And now we are on to the 1950s. We talked a little bit about Jack Brickhouse and Irv calling all the Chicago Bears games, which started actually in 1953. It was a few years later that WGN hired Ward Quall as VP and general manager of the station.
Yeah, he joined WGN when he graduated from Northwestern University, worked in various positions. He was an announcer, a special assistant to the general manager, and things like that. You know, when he went to the University of Michigan, Quall did, and when he was a freshman, on a questionnaire that he had to complete as he started his career at the University of Michigan, he wrote, "Someday I want to be a WGN staff announcer."
Really?
That's what he wrote on that. And 4 years later, almost as quickly as he could get out of his commencement gown, I think.
Yeah.
He made good on that ambition. And by the time he retired, he was president of Continental Broadcasting, WGN Continental Broadcasting.
Which is wild. I mean, he did start as a kid here doing just announcing and sports shows.
Those were the days that people could start and move up the line on merit, on gumption,
yeah,
and on their abilities.
But think about that from coming right out of school,
right
up to the top,
right. And that was he had a big impact on WGN and on the programming and on the many people who worked here, and of course, there's so many people who listened here. Many people didn't even know who he was or didn't even care who he was, who were in the listening audience, but they could feel the effect of the work that he did and the influence he had on this station.
Now, he worked for Crosley Broadcasting for a little while, too, in Ohio.
Yeah, but then he left GN for that and came in. Well, so he got a little more experience and stepped up a little bit, and they got him back, and then he was doing a wonderful job with all of this stuff. You know, I think he put Jack Brickhouse together with Eddie Hubbard. for a series of programs in the afternoon. It was like afternoon drive time.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, in those days, we really didn't have morning drive and afternoon drive and the middays and nighttime and all of this stuff. It was just there. And those two guys did a real good job. And they had many guests. And they'd have sports guests and showbiz guests and then average guests. They didn't rely on telephones, though. Not very much.
I have to think Jack lived here.
Like oh, yeah.
He had a cot.
Yeah.
I mean, he was on the road so much,
he was always
on the station.
Yeah.
Now, in the late 1950s, and I found this very interesting, in response to a growing number national problem of highway safety, you know, think about, you know, cars on the road. So WGN premiered a program called Signal 10. What's that all about?
Well, a sergeant from the Indiana State Police talked to traffic violators with the microphone. And the show was syndicated to points as far away as California and Europe, and it won a Sloan Award first Sloan Award ever given to a Chicago radio station. This was Sergeant Tim McCarthy of the Indiana State Police, and he had a WGN microphone with him, and he would talk to traffic violators. Now, they might be at an accident scene, or it might be someone who got a speeding ticket, or who got pulled over.
Some unique programming there.
Yeah. You'd wonder why the people would talk to him, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, it was radio. It was probably a big deal. Now, later in the spring, after being broadcast on WIND for a number of years, so there was a little bit of time where the Cubs, obviously they started in the 20s here, but they were on WIND for a short period of time.
In the early days,
some
of these games were on two or three stations at the same time. I mean,
really?
You could listen to the Cubs on GN, on WIND. You might hear them on WAIT. You might hear them on WCFL. And they'd have different announcers. But finally, they consolidated, and they said, wait a minute, we want this to be exclusive. And I think around this time, that's when the Cubs moved to an exclusive contract with WGN that continues now. It's still
sure.
here. And this is the radio home.
And then also that same year, you know, traffic coverage. You know, we talk about, you know, for the Chicago Department police officer, Leonard Baldy became the first flying officer. You know, this is a WGN helicopter.
Right. And he would be there mornings.
Yeah.
Morning drive time and I mean, afternoon drive time.
That's pretty inventive for back then.
Yeah. And a lot of that was coming from the traffic copter, the heliport.
Right.
Was at McClurg Court. Not McClurg Court. What am I saying? Bradley Place.
Bradley Place.
Bradley Place.
Yeah.
Over there. Yeah. Something else going on over at McClurg Court.
Yeah, that's it. Something else. We don't know what that is. That same year, we talk about, you know, radio coverage and obviously the news. Just a week after its debut, the WGN traffic copter, you know, gathered information not only for people listening but also for the authorities as well on the Our Lady of Angels School, that horrible, horrible fire that killed 92 kids and nuns, and it was just awful.
This is a case, too, where Wally Phillips on the radio would be very helpful in getting information disseminated. People around that area would call him up. And he'd put them on the air. I mean, they'd wiping out the commercials. They'd wipe out any preconceived programming, even though a lot of it was, you know.
Everything came to a halt.
And this was the focus of attention on there. And everybody would tune in. Let's tune in to Wally to find out what was going on.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Well, that was Wally and WGN, and Jack Brickhouse and WGN. Those names were all synonymous. It was probably number one in all the ratings all along the line for many, many years.
But that was a huge, huge, huge tragedy in Chicago. Again, on so many occasions, you know, WGN, and that's certainly what we do today, being live and local, you know, really we're one of the only stations in town that can offer that type of, not as far as, you know, it's conversation. It's conversation with the people that are out there as well and the listeners as well.
Sure.
So in 1960, a new voice was heard on WGN Radio, a legendary radio voice still heard on WGN Radio every day nearly 55 years later.
June hog futures are down 90 cents today at $119.67 a hundredweight, and June cattle down 65 cents a hundredweight.
And that's Orion Samuelson, and he'll join us next on 720 WGN. It's Dave Player on 720 WGN, and we're talking to my friend, radio historian and Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shaden on the history of WGN radio in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And now joining us is Radio Hall of Famer, WGN legend, Orion Samuelson. Good morning, Orion.
Well, good morning to you, and thank you for the opportunity to share some memories.
So how did you get your start? Like, what was the phone call that got you propelled up here to WGN in Chicago?
Well, 1960 was an interesting year for me because I was just completing my fourth year at WBAY Radio and TV in Green Bay, where I was part of a three-man farm broadcasting team, and we do 2 hours of radio in the morning and an hour of television every day at noon. And it was in 1960 that on April 30th, WLS stopped being the Prairie Farmers station that was listened to throughout the Midwest with its 50,000-watt clear channel signal, and it became wonderful rock and roll WLS, and made a lot of farmers in the Midwest very unhappy. Their kids probably not so much. But anyway, later on that year, in August, the farm director at WGN, which had been doing farm programming, but in the shadow of WLS, because that station was the dominant rural station in the Midwest. And in August, Norm Kraft, who was farm director at WGN, resigned on the air and walked out to join Senator John Kennedy's campaign staff, thinking he might become Secretary of Agriculture if Mr. Kennedy was elected. John Kennedy was elected, but Norm Kraft did not become secretary. And Ward Gwall, who was president of the company then, felt strongly that that 50,000-watt clear channel signal covered a lot of rural areas and that we had an obligation to serve that audience. And so he immediately started to search for a successor. For some reason, instead of picking a veteran like Herb Plambeck at WHO or Maynard Spies at WCCO in Minneapolis, he focused on Green Bay and offered me the job.
Now you were
took me 2 weeks to decide, and I look back on that and think, oh my God, what if I just said no?
Well, you were a big fish in a small pond up there, right?
Up there, I was a very big fish in a small pond, and the Chicago market. Well, I took a look at home prices because I had just built a home in Green Bay, and I took a look at home prices in Chicago, and they were twice what they were in Green Bay, and you know, I would be a little fish in a big ocean in Chicago, and I had the feeling that if you made a mistake, there'd be four people there to take your place. But I finally decided I'd come to WGN, stay 5 years, get it on my resume, and then go back to Wisconsin and buy a little radio station. And that was 53 and a half years ago, so I guess I'll stay.
You could do that at your 60th. You could go and get it.
Right. Yeah, I could.
So you were hosting several shows at the station besides doing reports.
Well, they were doing a lot of agricultural programming, and I quickly realized that besides serving farmers with information, I could serve them by helping city people understand what it took to put food on the table and a roof over their head and clothes on their back and that sort of thing. And so we did a 30-minute show in the morning, 5 o'clock every day, called Milking Time, because we had a lot of dairy farmers listening on the barn radio at that time of day. And then we did a show at noon, a full hour, called Country Fair. And on that show, we did all of the Midwest agricultural weather, the Board of Trade grain prices, the Union Stockyards of Chicago cash livestock markets, and that. And we also had a live band on the show. We had Eddie Mum and the Country Fair Boys, and vocalist Elaine Rogers, who many people heard. She made a lot of money off this. She was the voice that sang "Where There's Life, There's Bud" on the Budweiser commercials.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And on the one day a week that they would have to be off because of union rules, Bob Trendler and his 16-piece orchestra was with me in the studio. So,
which again, people know him best from being the orchestra leader on Bozo Circus, but he was the WGN radio orchestra leader for decades here.
Yes, he was. Yes.
Now, music on WGN, you know, you actually helped save the Barn Dance, but first I want to ask Chuck, tell us a little history on where the Barn Dance was so many decades
ago. The WLS
before.
Barn Dance, yeah. Well, the Barn Dance crew, the people who've been broadcasting the Barn Dance from 1929
Wow.
Until just, well, in 1960 is when it changed. And within a few days into the last week of their show, that's when they were told that the barn dance was going to be kaput.
Rock and roll was here to stay.
That's right. Yeah. And so they did a big final broadcast, but it was bittersweet, as you if you would ever have a chance to hear that broadcast. You know,
for being on the air for that 31
years.
Yeah,
oh,
my
gosh. And some of those performers were there all through the greatest part of that whole business there, 30-some years. And then they moved over to WGN. And once again, Orion was involved in that, and Ward Qual said, yeah, let's find a spot for them over
here. Yeah, tell us the story, Orion.
Well, the story is, since I had grown up listening to the WLS National Barn Dance every Saturday night, I was really troubled and bothered by the fact that, number one, they were out of work and the show was gone. And so I talked to Ward Qual, who had hired me, and of course I'm very new on the job, but I told him that there was an audience for that show, and these people are unemployed. Could we do something about it? And he said, I think we can. So in 1961, we hired Bob Atcher, Dolph Hewitt and the Sage Riders, the Johnson Sisters, Arky the Arkansas Woodchopper, Bob and Bobby Thomas, father-son team from Iowa, and Cousin Tilford. And we did, on Saturday night, two shows in Studio 3 at Bradley Place, because we could seat about 300 people there. We built a full stage for the barn dance, and we'd start rehearsal about 2 in the afternoon, and then at 6:30, we would do the 30-minute television show that later was syndicated, so it appeared on many other stations. And then at 7, when we finished that show, we'd turn the audience out and bring in a new audience. And at 8 o'clock, we'd go live on WGN Radio, and we did a 90-minute show on WGN Radio with the barn dance. And that happened until 1969. I was the announcer on the show, would introduce the segments, and I would also do all the commercials. And so we kept it going till 1969.
And at that time, too, you were the radio operations moved in 1961 over to the television station. You were in Studio 3, I think, when you did that. But
right.
with all the other shows going on there, and then it was Donahue and Bozo Circus, that was really the hub, the busiest place on earth, really, as far as television and radio production.
Yeah, I don't know any. Well, I don't think there was any other station in Chicago that did the amount of live programming we did, because television, for example, I'd be on the air from 6:30 to 7 a.m. every day with Top of the Morning, and then Ray Rainer would come in at 7 to 8. And then the audience would start coming in for the Phil Donahue show, and before they moved into the studio, the audience was coming in for the Bozo show at noon. Just a revolving audience, and that went on for many years.
Yeah. You know, when the barn dance was on WLS in the early years, those 30-some years, they were on LS the entire Saturday night, starting at 7 or 7:30, going up to 11 or later. And
wow.
They did two shows
right.
for two audiences,
right.
plus a half hour for the network. And it was the only radio show at that time in the history of radio that charged an admission price.
Yeah, because you go to, yeah, right.
For the audience. Because most of the time the radio show would be free to the public.
Sure.
It was, the starting place for Gene Autry, for mm-hmm. Pat Buttram, for George Gobel. They all started.
Right, yeah.
And it took place in the 8th Street Theater, which mm-hmm. is now the International Ballroom of the Conrad Hilton Hotel.
My folks took me to the 8th Street Theater one Saturday night to see the National Barn
Dance. Is that right?
Yeah, and we were about halfway into the theater, big 300-500 seats, I suppose. And in front of us, there was a row of people who obviously were farmers.
Right.
My dad said, these are farmers. And I said, well, how do you know they're farmers? And he says, look at the back of their necks. They're all red from working
right.
out in the field.
Sunburned.
In the sun. Yeah, right. And they were. But it was an amazing thing.
Well, Orion, too, you said there was a lot of big stars during the WGN days that were on the show, too. Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash came in to do the show. Eddie Arnold, who was a very big name in Nashville on WSM, he came in. Minnie Pearl. I remember Minnie Pearl coming in to do her comedy routine. And, yeah, there were a lot of stars that made their way into that studio.
Well, to continue on about the 60s here, in 1962, WGN celebrated its 40th anniversary, Chuck, with it was a three-hour broadcast.
Yeah, a big show on WGN, and it was hosted by Jack Brickhouse. Pierre Andre and Eddie Hubbard had Robert Trendler in the orchestra, and there were a lot of special people appearing on the show. Of course, Quinn Ryan, who was one of the very first announcers from WGN. Bob Elson, the sportscaster. Hello, fans, he'd say. And Shirley Bell, who was Little Orphan Annie in the 1930s. And that was sponsored by Ovaltine, which around 1940 changed allegiance from Orphan Annie to Captain Midnight.
Right.
And then Ovaltine continued through all of that stuff on GN.
And Ralston, well, as a kid, I would listen to that strip, 5:15 Superman, 5:30 Captain Midnight, and 5:45 Tom Mix. And Tom Mix was sponsored by Ralston. And the
Curly Bradley played Tom Mix on that show.
That's right, he did. Yes.
Then there was the 1960s. Now by 1965, Orion, you started working with Wally Phillips, which became like almost a 22-year relationship in the morning time.
Indeed, and I think he liked me personally, but he didn't think that a big Chicago radio stations should be doing hog prices and cattle prices and corn and soybeans. And I think he tried to convince the management. He later denied this. But I think early he tried to convince management that that kind of information should be done by a rural station in a small town, shouldn't be done on a big city station. So I would say, Wally, you tried to get me off the air. And later he denied that vehemently. And then wrote me a letter shortly before he died that is in my book, a letter that really had me in tears because he was just very kind. But he had the fastest mind of anybody I've ever worked with in radio. I mean, he reacted to phone call conversations with humor.
His telephone bits were hysterical.
They were. Yeah, they were. And, of course, there was a time when he would put the listeners on the phone and not tell them. And I think that brought the FCC. I think they call it the Wally Phillips rule.
Is that
if you're
going
to put them on the air, you got to tell them first.
Yeah, I bet. But 21 years on morning radio, I mean, when people really talk about morning radio in Chicago, Wally Phillips, that's Wally the name Phillips. That people talk about.
Oh, absolutely.
He was able to combine, you know, not only, you know, news and traffic and weather, obviously, in the morning, but entertainment, humor, information, public service. It was something that, I mean, he really kind of created that genre in the mid-1960s.
He really did, and he could go. Two people I've worked with on morning radio, Wally was the first and Bob Collins was the second, who could go from the silliest subject to a subject like gun control or abortion in a minute and not lose any credibility with the audience. And to me, that is a real talent, and Wally certainly did it, and Bob, who followed, did it as well.
Well, he brought the audience into it when there was a special tragedy of some sort that went on, right? The elevated crash or something else.
Yes.
And he'd get people on the street, that they would be calling into the station and giving a report. They'd say, this is not from the street, because they didn't have cell phones.
Yeah, they didn't have cell phones.
But they were at a telephone or in a booth or some in a home. And we got the word out just like that. And it would seem to me that in so many cases, if you wanted to know what was happening, WGN and Wally Phillips is
you
where you went.
You had to be.
All right, Orion, thank you for joining us as well. As always, a busy day for you, and you can hear Orion every day here on 720 WGN.
Thank you for the opportunity to share the memories.
All right, and you can find Chuck Shaden and thousands of amazing interviews from the golden age of radio at speakingofradio.com. Gentlemen, thank you again, and have a great Sunday.
Thank you.
You too.
All right, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN.